And welcome back to this week's edition of Insights into the Weekly Parsha on this beautiful Thursday morning. It's a slight little chill here in South Florida, but beautiful nonetheless. Wonderful weather, wonderful day. Getting ready, can sense and feel Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Vayishlach, our Parsha this week. For those of you who'd like to follow with us in our Parsha class this morning in the Art Scroll, Bluestone Chumashim, page 170 in the Hebrew, page 171 in the English. For those of you who'd like to follow along, we have a jam-packed Parsha, some very insightful thoughts from our Parsha with life application to share it with each and every one of you, for us all together to be inspired, to be uplifted, and to have lives of meaning. So, of course, we know that the beginning of our Parsha this week describes the great encounter, the encounter of Yaakov Avinu after he had spent so many years away in the house of Lavan, of uncle, of the soon-to-be then his father-in-law, then his wives and his children and his property. How many years he spent away after the pursuit of his brother wanting his life. And now, Parshas Vayishlach, the encounter, the brothers are going to come together and there's going to be this rendezvous, there's going to be this meeting, and the drama comes to this extraordinary head and all of the details and all of the commentary to think about how much meaning there is. The Torah tells us at the beginning of our parsha, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefonav, that Yaakov, Jacob, our forefather, he sends messengers, Lefonav El Esav, to his brother, to Esav, Achiv Arza Seir Sedeh Edom. We are taught of the topography, of the geography in Seir, in the country of Edom. And now it is what he sends. What does he send? So the parsha begins with this humble, it's a conciliatory message. He sends his brother as he makes his way back to Eretz Yisrael, makes his way back to Canaan after he was in escape of Esav, and now he's going to confront Esav. But here's what's fascinating. As he commands, as he directs these malachim that there's going to be this encounter, and he instructs these malachim, these angels, these emissaries, these ambassadors, the envoy, he tells them, this is what you should say to Esav. Tell him, you should know that I, your servant, Jacob, here we're about to meet. There's going to be a whole presentation of the gifts that are headed your way. But here are two very interesting components of how he introduces what it is that Esav should hear. Esav should know. Im lovan garti va'echar ad ata. You should know, I stayed and I lived with and I thrived with and I remained with lovan, lovan garti, and I remained intact, and I was solid, and I have been successful until this point. And for me, it is shor v'chamor. I have acquired quite an ample amount of property, an ample amount of livestock, of animals, of rechush, shor v'chamor, tzon v'eved v'shivcha. And it's been with cattle and chamorim, with donkeys and sheep and male sheep and female slaves, all of the things. And I want you to know, I'm sending this message to you, not as a fight, not as a threat, but I'm sending this message to you, to Esav, in the hope of one thing, that I should find and regain favor in your eyes. Obviously, it was acrimonious the last time we were together. You were coming after me to bring my life to an end. I had to run for my life. I had to save my life at our mother's binding. And now I'm back, and I'm hoping, as I enter now into Eretz Yisrael, it should just be that it should be pleasing, and I should regain favor in your eye. Now, these words, Im Lavan Garti, and his description of the shore of a chamor, tzon, ve'eved, shivcha, etc., all of his property, all of his belonging, all of his rechush, all of his successes, let's focus our attention, if we can, a little bit in understanding what this means and how it applies to our lives. So the Rechaim HaKodesh explains, what does it mean, love and guarantee? The Rechaim explains that what is it specifically that Yaakov is telling Esav? He's giving a whole drosha. Was he really, says the Rechaim, telling Esav something that he didn't know? Like maybe Esav, who was clearly a very successful person in some capacity, maybe he followed Yaakov. Now, it's true they didn't have Instagram, they didn't have social media, they didn't have ways of interacting with each other the way we do today. People's location, you can have them identified, find your phone, find your friend, find this institution. You can do that in a snap, crackle, and a pop. But here, says the Archaim, maybe it really is something Esav knew. Now, maybe explains that this was the minhag, this was the custom between brothers who are on good terms to exchange certain details about their experiences in life. It's an interesting angle that the Or Chaim explains and takes, which is, you know, imagine you have a family reunion. Chanukah is coming up. You're going to have a family gathering, whether it's safely live or whether it's going to be on Zoom. And when you see your brothers, you see your sisters, you see your aunts, uncles, your nieces, your nephews, your family, your extended family, so you share the experiences in your life. So how have things been going in school, in your business, in your personal life? Tell us, share with me, tell me some of these experiences. So that's what people do, says the Or Chaim. The details that are exchanged between people are on good terms. So that's what people do. So Yaakov Avinu may have done so in order to show that he considered himself on good terms with Esav. You know, it's not just, I want you to find favor in me. That all of that animosity, that hatred, that desire to kill me, all of that should be dissipated, should be gone. But how's that going to be? I'm going to be regular with you. You ever have somebody where you know that there's some tension, there's piru, there's machlokas, there's some hardship, there's some, I don't know, there's some anxiety. It's not comfortable. There's some great discomfort between two parties. You know, one of the things you could do is just act regular, act normal. So how's it going? How's your family? How's the business? How's your personal life? So some level, says the Or Chaim, im love and garanti, he was just shooting the breeze with him, just telling him about how things have been going. I've been living with Lavan. I've accumulated wealth. I have a family. I have wives. I have children. I have livestock. I have slaves. I have wealth, I have success. So one level of it, just shooting the breeze, just telling him that when we talk in such a manner, it's considering that we're on good terms. And that's what he was trying to do. Don't just think that it's always going to be so simple that this person, this Esav, this antagonizer, this other person for whom you have pirud, machlokas, dissension, that they're necessarily going to be able to limtzochein be'einecha, find favor and peace and tranquility with you. What you say and what you say to them is very much dependent on how regular, so it seems, says the Or Chaim, that you act with this person. Maybe what Yaakov was trying to do was trying to disguise the tension by just being regular. How is it that you've been to consider himself on good terms with Esav? Okay, so that's one understanding, perhaps a little less known. Interesting interpretation, again, is there are so many plethora of different Mefarshim commentaries. Im lov and garti, what lov and garti means, I'm just simply telling you how the past 20 plus years have been for me, because we can be on good terms. That is one interpretation. But the interpretation we're going to focus our attention really more focused on is the conversation that we will have on the commentary of the Perush of Rashi. Now, Rashi cites the Medrash Tanchuma, and Rashi has two explanations. Now, the first explanation, which is actually the second explanation, is fairly well known. What is it that's the first explanation that we discuss, which is the second that everybody knows? You should just know what it means, is the following, that Davar Acher, and the Davar Acher is going on the first statement, which we'll get to that first statement in just a minute, because the first statement is where we're going to focus our attention. But the Davar Acher, the second statement, is Garti Begamatri, the word Garti, that I've dwelled, I've sojourned, I've lived with. So Garti Begamatri, the numerical correspondence, is Taryag, you know, Tafresh Gimel, Taryag 613, Kilaymar, as if what he was saying to me, Lavan Garti, I lived with Lavan, and everybody knows it's Rashi. Vitaryag Mitzvah Shemarati, Vlalamadati Masim Haraim, you should know that I lived with Lavan Harosha. He was an evil, wicked man, dubious and deceiving. He was hard to live with. She changed my wages. How many times? At the end of his time there, he said, how many times did he change my wages? By the heat of the sun, the scorch of the burn of the hut, the summery days, and by the, you know, the frigid of the winter, the icicles that were on my, you know, on my lips and hanging from my ears, the way I worked for you was so loyal, so faithful, so dedicated. You have been, you know, dubious and deceptive since I met you, first with the switching of the daughters and then the changing of my wages. How many times? Here, Esav, I got a message for you. Messengers, Malachim, send this message to Esav. Garti begamatre tayag, I have lived with Lavan v'tayag mitzvah shamarti, and I have kept the mitzvos, all of them, not some of them, all of them. I've been shomer the mitzvos, and I'm able to do it in that climate. I'm able to do it in that audience. I'm able to do it this evildoer, this deceptive person. I have not sunk down to a level where I've learned evil ways from a wicked person. And so therefore you should know that your ways will not impact me. They won't influence me. They don't scare me. If I was able to do what I did over these past number of years and still nonetheless be steadfast, just by virtue of the fact that I'm sending malachim, shows that I saw angels at the beginning of my journey to the Bais of Lavan, Malachim are Oilim v'Yardimbo, and the Sulam and the Chalom and the dream of the ladder that Yaakov Avinu has as he's leaving Canaan. And I perceive angels as I've now re-entered into Eretz Yisrael, that these are the angels that were waiting for him. And now in Parshas Vayishlach, we introduce what the job of these angels, of course, is. So here's what it is. Here's what we understand, is that he's telling him, don't think that you have this on me. I am familiar. I know well. I smell trouble and I see trouble. And I know that people will try, who have a dubious way, a rebellious style, they're going to try as best they can to teach me Masim HaRayim. But you should know, Mitzvah Shamarti, Tarag Mitzvah Shamarti, V'lo Lamadati Masim HaRayim, I have not learned from these evil ways. And so therefore, stand back. I stand tall. You will not be successful at all. That is the first interpretation that many people know, but people fail to remember that that's actually the second interpretation. And it's interesting to note that the first explanation, which is vastly different than the second, they represent what I perceive to be two different attitudes, two different thoughts, two different attempts as to how he would engage with Esav, with his nemesis, which who he thought would be his nemesis, but now he hopes is not going to be an antagonist, but is going to be his brother. But here's what he tells him. Here's the first explanation of Rashi. And this is vastly different from the second, like, you know, threatening, like, I'm not worried, I'm not intimidated by you, but here's the first. What is Imlovan Garti? Garti, what does it mean? Rashi says in the first interpretation, Lo nasesi sar v'choshev. Eliger, you should know, I am not a choshev a person. Don't think that I'm a prince. I'm not a prince. I'm not an odom choshev. I'm not a person of importance. But you should know, Eliger, what does it mean, Eliger? I'm just a sojourner. I'm just a traveler. I'm just a visitor. I was just perceived as a regular person of not enormous consequence. I was not considered like a tsar. I wasn't given position of power. I wasn't given a position of prominence. I wasn't given any honor as a chosh of a person. I'm a ger. People just left me alone. I was just a sojourner, just a passerby. And you should know, why is he telling him that? So he's telling him that for one very simple reason. En chok hedai lisnoyosi. You should not be angry at me. You should not hate me. You should have sinna. Lisnoy oisi. You should not hate me for any reason. You know why? Why would you hate me? You would hate me. How did you start hating me? You hated me because of birchas avicha, because of the blessing of your father, of my father. When Yitzchak Avinu gives the bracha, thinking that it was Esav, but then ultimately knew that it was Yaakov, and he gives the bracha to Yaakov, right? As we're all familiar. So when he gets when he is given that bracha, that's when there's this sinna, there's this hatred, there's this pain, there's this desire, this admiration to kill, to destroy, to be destructive, his brother. So he says, don't be so worried about my status. Don't think that I've been in receipt of those brachos. Eincha kedai lisnoisi. It's not worth your while to hate me. You know why? Al birchas avicha sheberach shebechoni hevi gvir lachecha. Because what was the bracha? The bracha was that your father, it's interesting, he says, avicha, your father, right? Gives him the, it's your father. Our father, it really is our father. But it's in this context, Rashi says, he's talking as it's your father. It's not worth your while to hate me because the blessing that your father gave, Sheberachani Hevi Gvir Leachecha, what's the bracha? That you will be master over thy brethren, right? You're going to be Gvir, you're going to be stronger than your brother, meaning I will be stronger than you. You should know, Sharelani Niskaimabi, that hasn't been fulfilled through me. Says the Medrash, the Tanchumi Yoshan. That is, as Rashi quoting the Medrash Tanchumi Yoshan, you should know that even though that's the bracha, hasn't happened. And it hasn't happened, so don't be so angry at me. Don't have hatred towards me. Don't worry so much. You have no reason to be so vilified by my presence, and therefore maybe can we be brothers? Can we be friends again? Can we have congeniality? Can we be able to have peace and friendship? So that is actually the first interpretation of these two interpretations. The second interpretation is really the one that most people more commonly know. Steadfast, strong, robust, confident. And the first is, no, don't be so angry at me because you should know I didn't become much. Yaakov was telling Esav, in Rashi's words, I did not become an officer, a person of distinction. I'm a foreigner. You have no reason to hate me for the blessing which our father gave. Your father blessed me because that blessing that you should be Lord over your brother because it was not fulfilled for me. Now, that's very interesting in actually the flow of these psukim, because all of these psukim here, again, is Pasuk Dalid, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim, that's how the parasha begins, Pasuk Hey, Vayitzav Vayisam Lemor, that is Lavan, right? Im Lavan Garti, that's Hey, that's five. And then Pasuk Vav, and this is a Hemshech, a continuation of what seems to be Rashi's first interpretation. What does he say in Pasuk Vav in verse 6? Again, I'll tell you what, I have cattle, I have chamorim, I have donkeys, I have sheep, I have slaves. This is the message I'm telling you. So let's think and understand what that is. That with this interpretation of Yaakov telling Esav that I have not become a person of distinction, I am not a sar, I am not somebody important, I have not become Lord over you, the blessing, the bracha of our father, it has not been manifested. It's known as kaima bi. But here, this second expression of that, this next pasuk. So what do we understand? Yaakov Avinu again speaks of large herds of cattle that he amassed. So Rashi again explains that Yaakov sought to prove to Esav that the blessing also he stole, right? That he stole was not fulfilled. Yitzchak had blessed Yaakov that he should be granted the dew of the heavens, Tal Shamaya, that he should be granted the dew of the heavens, the fat of the earth. You'll remember, yeah. But the wealth here in this case came from cattle, came, you know, not from the agriculture as the promise was. So therefore, Esav had no reason to resent losing this bracha, which had, at that point, had proven ineffectual to Yaakov. That's not how he became wealthy. Now, it's very interesting, as this is what Rashi says in his very strong language. Abba Amarli Mitala Shamayim Mishmane Haaretz. Father told us that I'm going to be wealthy and I'm going to be prosperous. I'm going to be successful because of the dew of the heaven, the fat of the earth. You should know, Zo'eino lo mina Shamayim velo mina Haaretz. This didn't come from Shamayim, mina Haaretz. These are neither from the heavens or from the earth. It's not agriculture. It's cattle. It's livestock. It's sheep. It's chamorim. It's donkeys. So we have to understand. Yaakov seems to be, let's put off to the side, the second interpretation of Rashi, which is the confidence. Ah, I've lived with God, with love, and I've been strong and I'm steadfast and confident. No, no, no. Here, we'll go with the first interpretation of Rashi and the next pasuk Vav. We're saying, like, don't pay too much attention to me. Don't think so much of me. Because all of that which you think is manifest and has been unfolded in my favor because of the bracha of my father and of our father, it's not true. It hasn't happened. And because it hasn't happened, you have no reason to resent me. You have no reason to hate me. You have no reason to go against me. And so therefore, this is what seems to be, according to this interpretation, this simple reading of the Pesukim, seem to be the message that Yaakov Avinu is trying to convey to Esav. Now let's drill down a little bit deeper and try to understand really what this means. So the obvious question, obviously here, is that why is it, do we think, that Esav would assume that Yaakov's current circumstances would prove that the bracha had no effect? Like, why would that work? He's trying to regain favor. He's trying to have peace and shalom. He's shalva. He's trying to have tranquility. He's going to dwell in the land of Eretz Yisrael per the promise. So, but why would he think that that would work? If he's going to come to Esav, again, there's two different ways of trying to make peace. Become strong, you become peaceful with negotiations. Here, he's going to say, I'm weak, I'm feeble, I'm underestimated. Don't think that I'm, you know, up, I'm under. So seemingly what would be is that why would Esav think that his current circumstance of not being choshev and his current circumstance of how he accumulated his wealth would matter in the world of Esav ultimately thinking that bracha could come to fruition? Seemingly it was understood that Yitzchak's bracha to his son was intended for the distant future, right? Obviously, his son's offspring, the Zar Acha, your descendants and later generations, the Doridoros. And so that is presumably how Yaakov Avinu perceived the blessings he received, right? He perceived it that it's not like, okay, I have wealth this way, I have success and prosperity that way, and so therefore that's the do-all, be-all, end-all, that's how it is. No, 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 Yaakov understands that the brachos that he receives, the blessings that he's the recipient of, is the promises for his offspring, for his generations, henceforth. Now, obviously, we know, think about the life that Yaakov Avinu lived, the years of working for Lavan, and then, of course, with Dina, and all of the struggles in our parsha that he has, and then eventually with his children, his son Yosef. I mean, it's a very difficult time, very difficult life. And that's what he says when eventually he meets Paro, right? We all remember as he meets Paro, and he says the life of his sojourns were very difficult, very hard, very harsh. But he understands it's not now, it's not even in the here and now. It's going to be L'dari Daris. It's going to be for the offspring. It's going to be for generations henceforth to follow. So how then would his current circumstances demonstrate to Esav that he had no reason to resent losing the bracha? Like, it should be that also Esav would understand that as well. Now, just parenthetically, but no less importantly, but sometimes what happens with people is that people think, let's just say you are the beneficiary of some blessing, but it didn't come about the way you thought it was going to come about, right? It came about through other means. sometimes we are blinded even of the own blessings that we receive, because we are what we perceive to be the all-knowing, how things are supposed to play themselves out, right? So a person can be the beneficiary of some blessing, and it came about another way. I thought I was going to, you know, put a couple dollars down and win the lottery one way, but I won the lottery another way. And I'm not only talking about Dina Momentus here, I'm talking about in any area. Maybe the blessing, the bounty, the bracha that a person receives comes about in another way. But sometimes we have the unfortunate disposition to not really always remember or realize that the ways in the Ribbono Shel'olam are the ways of the Ribbono Shel'olam. Things happen as they're supposed to happen, and as they come, we are to accept them, to achieve an appreciation for these blessings, for the brachos, how they come. Not look at how they don't come or what's missing, what's lacking, but to realize what's gained, what is, what's there, what the bracha is as it is. And that's a very essential point. And that's actually, it's interesting because we also remember that as Yaakov was sending the gifts to Esav, right? So it says that as the gifts were sent to Esav, there was space between the various gifts and the various tribe, the various groups. Why was it the revach, the space? So Mefarshim explained, the commentaries teach, because that space, he understood that Esav is not going to look necessarily at the revach, at the bounty, but he's going to look at the what's chaser, at the space, at the lacking of the area that's not there. So maybe if he's going to focus on the area that's not there, then he's going to see that really he's not a blessed man. And therefore that revach, that space that was in between the gifts was going to be what's going to call Esav's attention. But of course, the question still percolates, still remains. How would his current circumstances, the fact that he still is saying that he was successful, the fact that he was no Sarath, he was no Adam Choshev, how would that demonstrate to Esav that he had no reason to resent losing the blessing and therefore don't have hatred to me? So it has been suggested by a number of darshanim, a number of commentaries, that Rashi's explanation, it reflects a certain aspect of the character of Esav. And we have to also always remember, and when we talk about the personalities of biblical people, we have to also remember that the characters of, for example, Yaakov and Esav, while it's true, obviously, they were standalone personalities. We study their person. We study their midos. We study their character. We study their trials, their travels. We have to also remember that in the world of Chassidus and the world of Panimius, we understand that every person has multiple elements to them, to us. And the multiple elements that we have are represented by the Yaakov that's part of us and the Esav that's part of us. There are these struggles that are within us. It's not just that Rivka had these two nations that are warring inside her womb, her rechem, but every single person has the character, the Mida of Yaakov and the Mida of Esav that war within us as well. Sometimes, if we're lucky, the Yaakov Avinu is more dominant. It's the Kol Yaakov. It's the voice of moral and ethics and principles, right? And then sometimes, later, Rahman al-Aslan, it's the voice that is silenced, but it's the Hayadayim Yidei Esav. It's the thunderous ways and the character flaws of Esav that's dominant. So we have to understand that there are midos of each of them that are influential to Dorei Doros, to generations, and are influential to us, likewise, as well. And we have to understand that when we learn the character of people, personalities, biblical personalities like Yaakov and Esav, we have to understand that the character that we describe is the character that we describe in ourselves. And the character that we describe in ourselves, when it's flawed, we have to correct, we have to build, we have to grow, we have to be better. So what is it that the Darshanim explain Rashi's comments to reflect a certain Midah Vesav? What is the character of the Midah Vesav we're talking about? And that is, namely, his attention was focused primarily on the here and now. And this is a yisoid, this is a very fundamental thing, that there's a difference between focusing on the here and now, on immediate surroundings, immediate circumstances, and the focus on long-term vision. What is the yomai and the shavuai in the language of Sfiras HaOmer? There's the days and there's the weeks. There's the short term, there's the here, there's the now, there's the immediate, there's the circumstances, there's the right here, right now. I don't have to think so much about what happened in the past. I'm not interested in what happens in the future. I'm not interested in long-term vision. I am not a roes hanolad, as the Mishnah Perkei Avos tells us, one should be a roes hanolad. That is who Esav was. He was in the here and the now. And obviously it goes without saying, when you're in the here and now in the world of what you're doing in the mitzvos, you have to be fully focused. You know, if you're sitting on your iPhone while you're, you know, listening to Dvar Halacha between Mincha and Ma'ariv, you're not present, you're not there. The concept of the psychology term of the struggle, the trial, the tribulation of the absence presence. What's the absence presence? You're absent, you're present, but you're really absent. It's like the you know, the example of the daddy who's at the park, you know, with their children, they're pushing their kids on the swings. But while they're pushing the children on the swings, they're on their phone, they're answering an email, they're leaving a voice note. So he comes back home with the child and the wife says, oh, so nice of you to take the kids to the park. So in his mind, he thinks he took the child to the park when reality was he at the park? He was present physically in the park, but he was emotionally, in his mind, he was completely distant. He was as far as could possibly be. Sometimes you have even husbands and wives, close families. They go out to dinner, husband and wife, they're both on their phones. So you can say you went out for dinner, you had a date night. The best date nights, husband and wives, is when you go and you leave the phones in the car, whether it's at a restaurant, whether it's even in your own home, when it's with your family at dinner, when you leave all those distractions, because the worry of the absence presence is that you're present, but you're not really present. So the immediate circumstances, obviously you have to be present when you're doing something completely. Not to the exclusion, though, of long-term optics, I'll learn to long-term vision, how a person thinks about l'dorei doros. So, for example, some commentaries have explained that Esau is prepared to sell his birthright. You remember, right? The Bechaira, which we learned together a few weeks ago, that the Bechaira, the birthright, which he spurned, right? He was spurning, he was disregarding the importance of the birthright. Why? Because the privileges of the birthright, which would come only in the future, right? For the sake of satisfying his hunger on a particular occasion, he comes in from the field, he's starving, he feels like he's gonna die, feels like he can't survive. Give me some of that hot red stuff. I need some of that food to sustain me. So it's for the moment, but it's not about the future. Birthright, wearing the birthright today. Ah, their privileges. The privileges aren't today. It's something that's down in the future. I can't think about the future right now. I'm not interested in the future. I'm interested in right here, right now. So therefore the satisfying of his hunger on one particular occasion, look what he gave up. Look at he's upset at the fact that Yaakov stole the brachos from him. He didn't care about the brachos. He didn't care about the birthright. He didn't care about this special status, the privileges that come with being a bechor. And he gave that up. Why? Because of the here and the now. He looked at his current circumstances and he chose to satisfy his immediate desire at the expense of an invaluable future opportunity, right? Because the future would provide this incredible opportunity with this birthright, with the certificate, with the status. Everyone's so concerned about their status. Did you post your status? Did you post and update your status? What's your status? Your status, your status, your status. Everybody's concerned about their status today. What's your status? Maybe the status, what's your immediate status? What's your tomorrow status? What's the next status? The invaluable future opportunities, because he needed to have something today, right here, right now. It's the here and the now versus the osid, it's the future. The Medrash, which is cited by Rashi, then seeks to allude to the fact that this important difference between Yaakov and Esav. That's what Rashi is telling us. That Yaakov, of course, fully believed in the future fulfillment of his father's blessings. It's not that Yaakov felt those things. It's not like he felt, oh, I only got my bracha from cattle, from livestock, from chamorim, from seh, and I didn't get my blessing from the way Tati, from Abba, the way Daddy told me I'm going to be. No. He didn't say. Now, he would have been happy with it if that's how the blessing would have come out, because that's who Yaakov Avinu was. He didn't say, I wasn't a chush of a person, so therefore, look, I'm just a simple pauper, and what my father said wasn't. A tzaddik is goyzer, then it's mekayim. A righteous says it, so then it's going to be mekayim, we believe. He didn't feel that way. But from Yaakov's perspective, he fully believed in the future fulfillment of the bracha that his father gave him. I don't have it today. I'm going to have it tomorrow. I'm going to have it next week. I'm going to have it next year. I'm going to have it next century. I'm going to have it in my children, my grandchildren. I'm going to have it for my children's children. I'm going to have it for Dorei Doros. That's who Yaakov was. But from Esau's perspective, obviously, the fact that the brachos had gone unfulfilled for several decades, right? It's over 20 years that he was away. Oh, okay. So now, what's several decades? What's this amount of time? The several decades. So it seemed to Esav that this proved that they were worthless, right? They were meaningless. They were empty. They were not going to be fulfilled. It's 20 plus years. You're still not that guy that Abba said. So it must be it's not going to be. For somebody who sees only the present conditions and circumstances without any long-term consciousness, so a blessing that was not fulfilled for over 30 years will never be fulfilled. That's how people think. And that's wrong, obviously. You know, you have to have, yes, immediate focus. You have to have attention. Mitzvos, trichos, kavan. You have to have concentration, what it is that you're doing. There's an immediate condition and circumstances. But to do that without any long-term consciousness, that's derelict. That's missing the point. That's missing the goal. That's missing the second part of an incredibly important equation that requires present and future in a combustion of synergy together. And this is a very important idea to have both of these things. It's very interesting because it's a PhD, a professor of philosophy at the University of Haifa by the name of Dr. Ido Landau. He wrote extensively on the meaning of life and actually has a book, Finding Meaning in an Imperfect World, which I found, I read some parts of, which are just fascinating, very interesting. Just came out recently, Oxford University Press. So he wrote a piece for the Psychology Today, and the title of his piece is called Does Being in the Here and Now Increase Life's Meaning? He's talking about life's meaning. I'm thinking about Viktor Frankl and various other works when describing, discussing, understanding what is life's meaning, the writings of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, what's meaningful, how do you have meaningful lives? Transcending the present moment is often helpful, he writes. And this is very, very important. He said that in his research, he found that many people told him they take their lives to be insufficiently meaningful as they attribute this to what they see as their failure to be wholly in the here and now, that is to fully live in the present state alone. You know, some of those people, he said, discuss not being in the here and now as escaping from reality, right? So you have to be in the here and now, he said, that these subjects told him. When they're not in the here and now, they say they're thinking about what isn't real, doesn't exist, what happened in the past doesn't exist anymore, what happened will happen in the future doesn't exist. And so therefore, when we're not in the here and now, we're not relating to what is real. And not relating to what is real distracts and detracts from life's meaningfulness. That's what they say. And not only that, he said that some of those in his research, they see being in the here and now as being fully present, exercising all of one's capabilities, focusing on the conditions in which one is, and thus living more intensely and deliberately, all of which associate with having a meaningful life. Now, all of that is true. It's true. You have to be deliberate and intense about the here and the now. We can never forego just because of things that happened in the past. And even though it might seem that things in the future are just unknown and there's an absence of a very great specifics about the future. We talk about the future. We talk about our children and our grandchildren and our generations that follow, but we can't see it. We're people that like to see things. We're people that like to touch things. We're tangible people, physical people. We don't like to think of things in these esoteric, unknown ways. And even though that's a tremendous focus of how much we motivate ourselves to do things because of our children, because of our generations, it's true. We need to be fully present, exercise the capabilities of focusing on the condition which one is, living more intensely, more deliberately. Obviously, it goes without saying, then you'll have a more meaningful life. But here's the very important difference, because many people also associate being in the here and now with controlling oneself and one's thoughts, coping with the condition that one finds oneself in and acting rather than just musing passively, obviously. Now, these are associated with having a meaningful life, no question. That's without question. The distractions that people have, the noise, the static, the difficulty that people just can't concentrate on the things that are so essential. I know I don't want to be misunderstood. That is critically, critically, critically important. But there's another second factor, and this is what he says in his article, in his piece. I'm just paraphrasing. He says that, in fact, not being in the here and now can often significantly enhance meaning to life and meaning in life as well. What does that mean? What does it mean? Meaning, if there's so much focus on the here and now, say his research and his finding and his study and his life passion, and this, of course, is what we're learning from an understanding in Rashi, is that, of course, the here and now is so significant. However, not being only in the here and now, I would add, not being in the here and now can often significantly enhance meaning in life. For example, now, if you think about good things that we did, or that happened to us in the past, that can empower us, right? You had an opportunity, you had a conversation, you have a relationship, you have things that were very positive that can empower you, because even though, you know, it can remind you that although at the present, you might be high, it might be problematic, it might be very difficult, you might be struggling, it might be hard, you might be, you know, suffering in some capacity, there may have been very good, meaningful aspects to your life. And now that our life taken as a whole has much more meaning, is much more meaningful than it appears now. So if you take like the aggregate, the whole component, the whole story, so then that's good. Then you could think of, okay, it's a bad day today. I had a great day yesterday. And if it's Hashem, please God, I'm going to have a good day tomorrow. Take the aggregate of the whole thing. So focusing on good things that happened in the past, it can also, you know, be a reminder to help us that although we're in a bad place now, our life isn't essentially bad. It's not meaningless. It's not barren. It's not empty. It's good. It's wonderful. Maybe things are bad now since they haven't, right? There have been better times in the past, right? It is likely that there also will be good things in the future. I have a very good friend who I cherish our friendship, extension of our family, who likes to tell us, in 10 years, it's not going to matter. And if it's not going to matter, right, Lindy, tell us all the time, if it's not going to matter in 10 years, then why should it matter now? Because if it's bad now, then in the future, it's going to be good. Don't worry about that. The future is promising. The future is bright. This can help keep us in mind that the bad right now, hopefully, is just a temporary crisis, a difficult period that we need to pass. Things will improve. It's true. In the times we live in, you know, not living in the here and now can also help us recognize that most people's lives are made of both low and high points, right? We all have that. We have times where it's better, times that are worse, times that are struggling, times that are successful, triumphs and tragedies, hardships, toils, tumultuous and goodness. We might be at a low point now, but there are good reasons to think and know that this is going to train. You know, this will change for us. Now, transcending the here and now can also help us put things in perspective. Yes, it's what's happening is bad. You could say it's terrible, but the context of our whole life, is it really terrible as it seems? Is it really so bad? It's not so bad. It's possible in 20 years, 2 years, even 2 months, 2 weeks, 2 hours, things will be great. Think big. Think great. Be positive. You know, there's so much literature and study and research about how you think, the positive thinking, how a person perceives things to be is how things become. You think positive, you become positive. You have positive thoughts, you maintain those positive thoughts. It's not just achieving it, but it's maintaining it. What is here and now usually seems bigger than it really is simply because it is so close to us, just as when we put a small coin close to the eye, right? You have that small coin close to the eye. It looks immense. It conceals us from the rest of the universe, right? All the little, a dime close to your eye. So it's very small. It's minute. It's minutia compared to the rest of the universe. So seeing it, its real size, and comparing it to other things provides perspective and context. Take a kernel of sand. And you hold that little piece, that one small, insignificant nothing, a blade of grass. It's zero. But when you put it in the context of everything, it's a part of the constellation of the world, and it's part of a beautiful, beautiful forest. The trees are a beautiful plain of grass, or a beautiful shore of sand that lie on the seabed, on the shore. You see that it's part of a greater, bigger picture, and therefore seeing the bigger picture is part of the here and the now. The here and the now, you're not stymied, you're not stuck. We're not supposed to binge watch the Netflix all day and to miss opportunities, chalila v'chas. But what we have to do in the here and now is also have it simultaneously be something that focuses our attention, likewise on the future. When you think about the future, it instills a sense of hope. You know, the future is what makes our present worthwhile. Why do I invest in this activity? Why am I engaged in this action? Why do I invest with my family, my children? One major difference between humans and animals is that we live in the future too. We make plans and we have hopes. This is a major reason why our lives have value. And of course, there are also wrong ways of being in the past and wrong ways of being in the future. When people passively muse and daydream about coping with what needs to be done, you know, you think in delirious terms of what was and what could be and what might be, a depression, a sadness, a hardship. What is written above, you know, of course, we have to understand what is written, what was, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what it will be. So it's so important for us to understand that our lives are rich. Our opportunities are plenty. The future is bright. The hope that we need to feel has to be lived. It has to be shared. It has to be animated. It has to be enthusiastic. And it has to be inspired. And so we, as the descendants, the heirs of Yaakov, of Jacob, our forefather, are thus reminded not to allow our present conditions and immediate needs to lead us to neglect the future. Chas v'shalom. God forbid, we can never neglect our future. Every decision that you make today affects the future. Every decision you made yesterday affected today. Every single thing that we engage has consequences. We have to remember that our circumstances in the present are fleeting and transient. The problems we confront today will be replaced by other problems in the future, right? Our priorities today will be replaced by with priorities in the future. And I'm not talking about like daily learning and daily davening. Those are priorities that we have. But even within the world of daily learning, daily prayer, daily good deeds, they're going to take different meaning because as you mature in life, so what prayer means to you when you're a youngster, what it means when you're middle-aged and when you're older obviously means different things. The word prayer is a word, is an expression, is an endeavor that is done throughout the corpus, the totality of a person's life. But of course, it has greater meaning. The mitzvos have greater meaning. The learning of Torah has greater meaning as you mature in your life. Now, even as we work to address our current conditions, times we live in, we have to live with an awareness, with an acute understanding of the future to ensure, to the best of our ability, to prepare for what lies ahead, rather than focusing exclusively on the here and now. And that's such an important lesson that we learned from this whole episode with Yaakov and Esav. You know what he was saying? Esav, I know your character. I know who you are. I know what's flawed. And the Esav that's within each and every one of us is a flawed character. trait. And that character trait that's flawed is where you think about the here and now only, to the exclusion of everything that comes in the future. Yaakov Avinu understood that the bounty came to me. This way it's going to come to me. If my father said it's going to be, if this is the promise of my tati, my abba, my father, this is what's going to be, lock, stock, and barrel, ironclad, without compromise, without question, no doubt, because I believe in the future. I believe in the hope. I believe that there's promise. I believe that there's a better tomorrow. This is true not only in this whole story of Yaakov Avinu with his brother and this rendezvous and this encounter, but it's also true with every situation in life. It's true in every encounter. It's true of us as individuals, with our families. It's true of us in our communities. It's true of us in the Jewish people, the Jewish world, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. It's true of humanity, all of us in this world, on this globe, together. We have to understand, if there is a promise by the Almighty that we are to be part of this narrative, that we are part of a holy people at a holy time, we are people who are an Or LaGoyim, to be a light unto the nations, to live a certain way, and that we will have promise and prosperity, that we will have hope and accomplishment, we can know very well that that is no doubt going to happen. I just want to end my talk, as I like to do sometimes, to share some analogies from the outside sports world, to just try to give this and put this into perspective a little bit. I know some of you wait for that, like that. So we'll share some of that just very quickly. It's all a matter of perspective. It's all a matter of how you train yourself and think about not just the here and now, but the here and the now is oftentimes motivated, almost exclusively, I should say, by understanding what is the future. So there is the men's basketball coach at the University of Michigan State, the Spartans, and the head coach of the men's basketball program at Michigan State, MSU, is a gentleman by the name of Tom Izzo. So the question of realizing the future, I think, is celebrated in an incredible first practice. You know, the team reports on the first practice, and they have to get ready for the exhibition games, and the preseason, the season itself, and hopefully March Madness, the postseason, and there's going to be the hope of being national champions. Now, do you know that, you know, what Michigan State head coach Tom Izzo had his team do at their first practice of the 1999-2000 season? I don't know if he still does this with every practice. It probably would make sense if he did. But here's what I know, and this is what they say. What happened at the beginning of the 1999-2000 season, Tom Izzo, head coach of the team, no shooting drills, no ball handling, no defense, no rebounding, no passing, no sprints. Well, I don't understand. What are you talking about? Right, the first practice basketball team, you're sitting there, shooting drills, you're going to pass the ball, you're going to ball handle, you're going to have some plays, you're going to figure out some sprints, some suicide runs. You do a whole host of just different things that are in line with what you do when you're on a basketball team. No, but the very first practice, he had his players do one thing that was unbelievable. They took a ladder, a tall ladder, and they brought the ladder to underneath the basket where the net was hanging down. And they opened up the ladder, and they placed it directly underneath the net. And at the very first practice, the very first thing he had his players do is he had them climb up that ladder with a scissors in their hands, and he had them practice cutting down the nets. That's right. They practiced cutting down the nets. Now, why is that important? Because any of you sports fans out there, you know, college basketball sports fans know that a national championship comes with great fanfare, great celebration. But then there's like a storied tradition. The storied tradition is that after the national champion team wins the championship and they jump all over each other like a bunch of Viltachayas, and they're screaming and celebrating and confetti's flying and people are jumping on each other, right? They take a ladder, they go under the net, and they ceremoniously, they cut a piece of the net and they hold it up real proud and real high. That is the symbol that we are champions. They take a piece of that net, they put it in their pocket, they probably frame it, they keep it for posterity. And that net, it's like tearing down the nets or cutting down the nets. We won a national championship. That is the last act that the team does after being crowned champions. So no ball handling, no shooting drills, no defense, no rebounding, no passing, no sprints. At the first practice, he had his players practice cutting down the nets. That's right, they practiced cutting down the nets. Because if you want to be a champion, if you want to think about being world champion, national champion, being a leader, being successful in the goal that you've set out by putting yourself on this court, you have to imagine the future. See yourself as a champion. See yourself cutting down a net. See yourself being successful. See yourself in the most brightest lights in the most positive of way. And when you do that, the first practice that would be after, which would be the second practice, that practice has brand new meaning. You're not running sprints or dribbling a ball without any other thought than I got to dribble this ball practice as a national champion. I got to practice as a leader, as a great success. When I do that, everything I do in the present is totally different. It's thinking about the future. So it must have worked, because less than 6 months later from that first practice, the coach, Coach Izzo, and the Spartans, they cut down the nets at the RCA Dome after they beat the Florida Gators. Sorry for my Florida watchers here, the Florida Gator fans. But they beat the Florida Gators for the national championship, because success can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. They won. That was the first national championship they won since 1979. And they won in that final game, 89-76. Fascinating statistic. But here we go. That success can only be as a measure of what a person perceives their success to be. Success can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's all about a person realizing, thinking about what the future is, what the future entails, what the future is. And when a person thinks like that, conditions themselves to be that way, to think that way, wow, the sky's the limit. So let's take the midos, the attributes of Yaakov Avinu, of Jacob, our forefather. Let's inculcate these beautiful ways into our ways. Let's think positively. Let's be hopeful. Let's think about a promise of a future. Let's think about a bright vision, the optics and the vision of what are beautiful days ahead. Never failing to appreciate that without the hardship and the struggles that every person is destined to have, that sets us back at times, but it's never meant to set us back terminally and fully and only. It's meant to animate and to inspire us to live days that are full of meaning, with passion, with hope, and with promise. I thank you all for listening, for joining me here in the Boca Jewish Center Zoom room. For those of you who are following on Facebook Live, I wish everybody a beautiful, uplifted, a happy Thursday. Happy Thursday and a good Nerev Shabbos, a good Shabbos Kodesh Parshas Vayishlach to you, to your families, healthy, happy, safe. Wishing you a beautiful day and a good Shabbos Kodesh.